If you will turn, first and foremost,
I'll put it down where
Page 24.
Yeah,
Jews, God, and history.
Okay. Jews, God, and history.
Page 24.
I think it's recording.
Great. If not, it's no worse than the three times I've already messed up.
Well, it's moving. I mean,
all right. Thank you.
Okay, what page do you want us on?
Page 24 in Jews, God, and history. Not in Living Judaism.
Oh.
The other one.
Yeah.
Do you have that one?
We have it at home.
Yeah, at home.
Uh-oh.
All right. There is one paragraph which encapsulates this introduction to Jewish history, which I really wanted to read out loud and make sure everyone understands completely. I don't believe in going through the whole thing. It's 24 pages, and basically it gets summed up in a single paragraph. So let's go on page 24, the last paragraph on that page. Anyone want to volunteer to read it out loud?
Yes, Ben.
Judy,
he has to, he
that
has
is so
book.
Dangerous.
You want me to read it out loud?
Yes, please.
The circle is complete, beginning with God as the creator of history. Man invented other explanations.
Well, excuse me, 24?
Page 24.
Okay.
An anarchy.
The last paragraph?
See, we're in a...
Yeah, hold on.
We have a
I'll
different edition.
Yeah, it's in the preface.
Okay.
I'll get to you in 1 second.
Yeah.
All right, in this edition, it's page 11.
Oh,
so page 11 at the bottom.
The circle.
So it depends on what edition you have as to whether you are with us on 24 or whether you're... No.
No?
Jews, God, no, we're in the Jews, God, and History, the one book you don't have yet.
Okay.
I didn't really expect you to be here tonight. For those who don't know, I was visiting Wayne and Sandra in the hospital this morning.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow.
You okay?
Hi.
There's two chairs right here.
Yeah.
Come on.
I can scoot over to
you. Yeah, you can
scoot
over to
the
way
here.
All right, so depending on which book you have, we're in Jews, God, and History. If you're in the hardcover, which I had, it's page 24. If you're in the soft cover, either way, it's the end of the introductory. And so I think page 11, and it's the last paragraph on that page, as I recall.
No wonder I've been getting my assignments screwed up.
Sorry.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Okay,
we can try to coordinate that and go over that in a little bit before we end class tonight to make sure everyone's on the same page. No pun intended. All right, Benny, you want to pick it up again?
And the circle is complete, beginning with God as the creator of history. Man invented other explanations, and anarchy one view in history as a series of combined events. A philosophic one looking at history as a series of purposive events, and economic and holding productive methods as determinant force, or physiological, one giving priority to unconscious drives. A great man theory viewing to the idea of the man himself as the creator of his historic destiny, and finally back to God at the helm.
Okay. Most of this introduction was all about how history is viewed or has been viewed historically. In Judaism, we understand that history is basically the story of the relationship between man and God. With that understanding, history is viewed a little differently. It's not a series of events. It's more a story of a relationship concept. We're more worried about that relationship history than we are about the events within it as a Jewish people. What's the difference? All right, do I really have to worry about whether there was a great battle at Megiddo? No, not unless it impacted the relationship between the Jewish people and God. What are those things that impact us most? We start. Abraham. Look at your timelines for a moment, and I want you to compare the timelines in Living Judaism. And I'm deleting the timeline altogether from what we're looking at from Jews, God, and History at the moment on purpose. As I recall, Living Judaism has its highlights. The timeline starts on 358. And I want you to pull up the timeline I handed out to everyone. If anyone needs an extra copy, let me know when I've done them. Now you're going to find there's something missing on the timeline that I gave you from Milton. Somebody look and tell me what's the first event on here, first thing on here.
Exodus from Egypt?
Israelite?
On this one.
Looks like Israelite.
Moses.
Moses.
Literally Moses, and that's, they're reading in as the 13th century BCE. According to most time history experts, we're going to place Abraham between 1800 and 2000 BCE.
Should we write that in?
Yes. Now comes the controversy. We know genealogically,
Moses.
We have family lines. Without going to full genealogy, real quick. Abraham's son Isaac, Isaac's son Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons, one of them is named Levi. Levi has a son named Amram and a daughter named Jochebed. Amram and Jochebed marry. That's not quite right, hold on. There's another in-between here. This is step two. I don't remember who Amram's father was. Amram literally marries his aunt. And their child is Moses. Now, the question becomes, could this have been from the time of Isaac's birth to the time of Moses, could that have been between 400 to 500 years?
Yeah.
And the answer is no. No matter how we do it, no matter how we parse it, we don't get 400 years between the two. We go literally, we don't have to worry about Abraham so much.
Cool.
We know his first child was born at 99, okay, no big deal. We got it. But we do want to say from the birth of Isaac to to the time of Moses, could we have 400 to 500 years passage? All right, here's where that 400 years comes from. In the Torah, God sends him a vision, and the words are that for 400 years, the people will be slaves in the land of Egypt. The historians until modern time, and by modern I'm talking about this century basically, not even the last century. 21st century is the first one that investigated this and started saying, wait a second, something's off. They did it because of a place called, what caused everyone to stop and really think was a city in Egypt called Avaris. Avaris is a city in the Delta, in the land of Goshen. For those who remember their Bible, that's where we were supposed to be. It is also where the Hittite shepherd kings had their capital. The Hittite shepherd kings were the pharaohs of that time. They had defeated northern Egypt and had taken over the title and the rule. The Hittites are close relatives of the Ivri, the Hebrews. When we read about Abraham coming from the city of Ur, it was not Ur of the down below, it was Ur of the north. There were two Urs. And when he leaves and actually leaves his father's house, and when we remember where he's actually leaving from, he's leaving from a city called Haran. Haran is in Turkey today. There's still a place called Haran. It's right near the ancient ruins of Haran. So he's basically coming from the Hittite kingdom.
Can you spell that? H-I?
H-I-T-T-I-T-E. Unless you're talking about Haran, which is H-A-R-A-N. Interestingly enough, the city and Abraham's brother, who dies on the trip going towards Canaan, Lot's father, also named Haran. City and man, the same name. So what we end up with is a discrepancy. Torah tells us it's 400 years that we're going to be in Egypt. And then we're going to be taken out. Problem with that is we basically have four generations total to the birth of Moses. And then figure one more generation because Moses is the age of 80 when he actually leads them out. Most historians now have adjusted that time frame. Instead of seeing it as being between 12 and 13 BCE that we have the Exodus, they're now pushing it back. And all of a sudden, something else comes to light. The city of Avaris is a recent excavation. Because of politics, they're not letting them do it in a normal way. Every summer, the Delta area and the farmlands that encompass the ancient city are excavated. And every time as summer ends, they are required to fill it all back in, dump all the sand and dirt back on, with markers if necessary, but they will not allow them to maintain the dig as a full dig year-round. Here's the amazing part. Avaris yielded so far seal rings with the name of Joseph, son of Jacob.
Wow. What kind of rings did they find?
In ancient days, you didn't just sign your papers. It was sealed. They were clay seals, or if you were really wealthy and important, the seals were often created out of precious or semi-precious stones. They have found sodalite and carnelian seals with the name of Joseph on it. They have found two of them with partial name, just Jacob on it. Now, an important official like Joseph would have had multiple seals because he would have delegated a whole bunch of people to act in his name. It would have been required. He could not have done it all on his own. This was the first time we've had archaeological backup to the Bible as history of that period. We've had it for other periods, but not for that period. This is the first time we actually get something.
What was the city? Where was the dig?
Avaris.
Avaris, okay.
Avaris.
How long has this been known?
They've been doing it now for like 14 years they've been doing this.
Wow.
They also found a stela. Does everyone know what a stela is?
A star.
No. A stela is a large piece of... total blank. They found a stela in Egypt that broke the hieroglyphic codes called the... starts with an R.
Rosetta Stone.
Rosetta Stone,
yeah.
Thank you. That's a stela. The stelas typically encompassed bragging about something or telling the history of. By the way, anyone who wants to go online, you can find Decoding Exodus, put out by the Discovery Channel. It will talk about both of these and it will show you actually some of the things they found. It's rather cool looking at this piece of stone that actually has in hieroglyphics the story almost of the Exodus as we know it.
Wow.
No joke. It talks about Pharaoh's army going out to bring back a group of slaves and being drowned. There's a lot in it. Unfortunately, it's not open for public view. It's been placed in the Cairo Museum, but under wraps. After this video was made and the Discovery Channel did their whole big video and so forth, they were banned from ever coming back when it was found out what they published. But again, it's on there. You can see it. It's hard physical evidence of a sort that we've never thought we would find.
And why would they be upset that they showed it?
Because it says that the Jews have a claim to ancient Israel, which means we have a claim to modern land Israel. The Palestinians and many of their cohorts are intent on rewriting history.
Right.
They've already claimed that we were never there, that we came all from Europe.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're not happy with what was found. By the way, the guy who found this is not Jewish. I think, and I may be wrong, he was either Scandinavian or German. But he smuggled a film crew in, he did the filming, and he published it then, and as I said, it was his own. He's been
so
kicked out.
I'm surprised they didn't just destroy it as soon as they found it.
Why they don't destroy
it's
it?
It's Egypt.
Yeah.
They actually do value their antiquities. I'm serious.
That's true.
In any case, because of Iris and the stela there, it caused everyone to go back to this and say, wait a second, the dating's off. And the dating is off between 300 to 400 years. It was further back. And we know this only because of the dating from Avaris itself. There they can do carbon dating of different items. There they can give a good, accurate estimate of when this existed and what was going on here at that time. The account that matches up to our account of the Bible is off in only one aspect, the timing. Biblical scholars for many, many years have discounted certain parts of the Bible, which also spoke of this type of discord or disagreement in times. This past weekend, for those who are in shul, we had the Haftorah of Yiftach. It's the Haftorah that goes with Hukat. And in it, there's a negotiation going on between the leader of the Israelites at that time and the Ammonites across the way. And Yiftach basically says, not basically, he says, for 400 years we've occupied this land and you've had no issue. Now the commentary that's going to be in every Chumash, including the new ones that just came out, says, well, Yiftach didn't know his history, he was off. It was really only 100 years. And yet, if we believe that the dating for Avaris is correct, then the 400 years that Yiftach speaks of is accurate. And he knew what he was talking about. Which makes a lot more sense than you figure that this guy was exaggerating and came up with his 400 when he's doing a negotiation before battle, before war. You wouldn't want to mess up too much on the time period of how long you've been there. So as much as we like to depend on timelines that we've created, the main thing I'm going to impress upon you, if I can, is that some of it's guesstimate. And we're still learning. We're finding things that deal with our relationship with God where we're not so worried about the actual timing. The question is, did the Exodus happen? My answer to you would be, historically, we're now starting to find proof that it really did happen. Did it happen exactly the way the Torah says it? I can't tell you that. I can tell you that there have been explanations for almost all of the plagues. Almost all. It's the coincidence of timing that would have to be explained. And I don't have an answer for some of that. Do I believe it really did happen? Yes. Do I believe it happened at the Red Sea? No. Mainly because that's not what it says in the Bible. The Bible doesn't say the Red Sea.
Sea of Reeds.
The Hebrew says the Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds.
Oh, wow.
We know there was a, quote, a marsh sea, full of quicksand, by the way, very treacherous, that existed to the side of where the Suez Canal is today and going into the Suez Canal area. When they drained it to get create the Suez Canal, that sea disappeared. It was fairly wide and covered a large area. It would also have been on the direct route going from Pitom and Ramses, these two cities that we were supposedly helped build, and where we all were, to go into Sinai. Whereas if we had done a crossing at the Red Sea, the question would be why? Because it's not only nowhere near where the people were, it would have been a much longer trek to get there. It doesn't work as far as the actual distances and days that we had to travel. There are people who have claimed to find pieces of chariots and evidence of an army being drowned in the Red Sea in one particular spot. I don't totally buy it. I have no question that there were times that there's been tidal waves, areas, and retreats and so forth, such as we see in different parts of the world in certain areas, the Bay of Fundy. I can see where you may have issues like that from an earthquake area and so forth and so on. But I'm not sure any of it leads us to absolutely believe that it was the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. Excuse me. What I am concerned about is who are we as a people? So let's go into chapter 2 now. And the whole purpose of this was to give us a background of, okay, we know it wasn't really 400 years in Egypt. Most likely 120 to 180. Still a long time. So why the number 400? The Bible, especially the Torah, delights in using the word 100 as a generational term. So if we read 400 and you translate that as four generations, it works. It's been done in several other places in the Torah where the rabbis have gotten together and finally figured out this is what it was, and they acknowledge it and they work with it. But for some reason, it was never applied to Abraham's dream and the prediction that we would be there for 400 years. If we accept that, then everything starts to fall into place. And then we have the proof of avarice, which reinforces it. When we start with Abraham, I gotta get to where I needed to be. Hold on.
Is this still recording?
Jewish names. You've already heard me use the word Ivri, which is in your first paragraph, translated as Hebrew. It comes from the word over, la'avor, to pass over, or to pass, to cross over. We cross over several rivers to get to Canaan. If you remember, when Jacob comes back down, he has to go over the Yarnok, the Yabuk, and that's where the whole thing of dividing into two camps and Esau comes in. Abraham had to pass over some of those same rivers. In order to get down to Canaan, he passes over from territory to territory, river to river. When we look at the name for the Ivrim, the Hebrews of ancient time, they weren't B'nai Abraham. They were not the children of Abraham. Very specifically, they were called the Ivrim, or the Ivri. The Hebrews. Today, we get confusion going because we don't like that term. We prefer Jews or B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. That term, B'nai Yisrael, comes in obviously after Abraham, and it has its own, if you will, baggage. We'll deal with it in a moment. The word Jew actually comes from the tribal area of Judah, named Judea, which the Romans named the province, the entire province. So if you were from Judea, you were a Jew. We've accepted that over history as the denomination, the denominator. B'nai Yisrael, children of Israel, specifically referred to the fact that each child ended up creating their own tribe. And so, therefore, they became the Israelites. Jacob was renamed Israel, one who wrestles with God, on the eve of his reconciliation with his brother Esau. B'nai Abraham, children of Abraham, was never used as one of the designators for us as a people. And as I said, it has a major problem if we look at it that way, because Abraham has two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. From Ishmael, the Arab nations trace their descent. So if we were to talk about B'nai Abraham, we're talking about Jews and Arabs. And yes, there's a difference, by the way, between the word Arab and Muslim. Not all Arabs are Muslim. And definitely not all Muslims are Arab. Indonesia is the largest majority country of Muslims in the world. None of them are Arab. So we have a close affinity, literally cousins, between us and the Arab nation. From the very beginning, though, it's not just family. So we come to section 2 in chapter 2. According to Jewish law, a Jew is a child born of a Jewish mother, a person who converts to Judaism. It's called matrilineal descent. You need to understand that in the beginning that was not the way it was recorded. In the earliest history, you were a Jew if your either parent was of the tribe. There are several examples of different judges and so forth who have come on in, and their identity is not in question. So how did we get to this part of matrilineal descent? In the period of the judges, we were constantly being raided. And these raids included rape. 9 months later, a child was to be born. The decision was made by the leaders of that time, the main judges, that the child would not be questioned with regard to paternity, and that the membership in the peoplehood would be determined by the mother's identity. Because prior to that, if the father did not acknowledge the child was kicked out. The idea of matrilineal descent was very simply based on the concept, we know who the mother is. We don't always know who the father is. In order to be fair to the child, we didn't really care about the mother and father. To be fair to the child, to safeguard the child's welfare, their identity was established. If they were born of a Jewish mother, a mother who is of the tribe of Israel, she gave the identity to that child. It could not be rejected. We don't have an exact year for it. We didn't need one. It was accepted. Patrilineality was not. And here I need to explain why. Abraham has, I said, two children. Actually, it's not really true.
More than two.
Abraham has eight.
Eight.
With Keturah, a wife he takes after the death of Sarah, he has six more sons. These six are not considered to be part of our peoplehood at all. We don't even know if they still exist. What we do know is that Ishmael literally plants himself and his family, all of his sons, in an ark between the other six sons of Abraham and Isaac, protecting Isaac from them. It's a really interesting little part of history. Isaac may not have been 100% operating level. Would not be too surprising. Mm-hmm. Those who were paying attention to last year's sermon or who were here, if you remember, Isaac is born of a relationship that is in prohibited relationship levels today. And by the way, Torah later says, no, don't do that anymore. Abraham marries his half-sister. They share the same father. The child is born very late in life. The married couple. Can anyone tell me what the odds are of a normal child in those circumstances?
About a billion to one.
The truth is, modern science tells us, don't count on it. You're going to end up with a Down syndrome or worse, greater disabilities. When you start to read the story of Isaac, he exhibits some of the symptoms that we would expect of a child who is not 100% mentally there. Or mentally capable. The worry that Sarah has about Ishmael playing with Isaac becomes clearer if Isaac is not a normal child and Ishmael is. Her concern is she doesn't want Ishmael to inherit. So she insists he be sent away, and yet we know that while he's sent away, Abraham also takes care of him. He is present at Abraham's death with his brother. It would make perfect sense if he really loves this younger baby brother, which is the only thing we've ever seen exhibited in the behavior up to that point, to put his own family, his sons, and their tribes in a protective circle around Isaac and what he has, because that was Daddy's will. And that's what we actually see in what the Bible lays out of where they encamp and what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's what happens. Patrilineality would have required the other six sons to be included in the inheritance. So even though they have an identity as the sons of Abraham, they actually go after their identity with the mother's tribes. It happens several times over. On the other hand, we have Menashe and Ephraim, two half-tribes, the sons of Joseph, who are the two that are born before Jacob enters into Egypt with the rest of the family. And Jacob feels it's necessary to adopt them formally, to bring them into the family. This would make sense if we're not talking patrilineality again. Their membership comes through the membership of the mother. Therefore, they would have been seen more as Egyptian. until Jacob adopts them. When Jacob adopts them, they become full-fledged members of the tribe. That's not the total story, though. And it comes into what we see as a legal binding marriage. And what is adultery? In Judaism, ancient Judaism, a man could have multiple wives. Polygamy was a norm. Abraham has a concubine at the same time he's married to Sarah. And he marries Keturah as well. We don't know the exact date on that, but we assume after the death of Sarah, but we're not 100% certain. It doesn't matter. Isaac ends up with only one. Jacob, four. We jump ahead a little bit in time to the ones we actually know about, because we're never told how many wives the others have. And we know that King David has 300 wives and concubines combined. Solomon has 1,000.
A 1,000 wives?
Wives and when I say wives, wives and concubines. Concubines were a secondary form of marriage. Here's the issue. For a man, the only way a man could commit adultery was to lie with a woman who was married to another man. Period. There was no other way to commit adultery for a man. For the man, it didn't say that if you laid with a woman, it was automatically adultery if you were married. It was only if she was married to somebody else, whether as a concubine or as a full wife. That was the only adultery that existed for a man, which meant children coming from outside of the marriage were common. I mentioned this past week's Haftorah of Hukat. Yiftach is scorned by the rest of his family because he was the son of a prostitute whom his father laid with. And they reject him. They do not accept him as part of the tribe, and they do not accept him as part of the family until they need him. He proves to be a really great warrior. He's leading a band of we would call it bandits. And he's really skilled. And when they're having trouble and they have no one to lead, they go to him and he says, "Why should I come to you? You kicked me out. And we'll rectify that. We'll make you a full member. We'll give you membership. It's all taken care of." And he does come back in. But the understanding there is, if it was patrilineality at that point, they couldn't have kicked him out to start with. Matrilineality, when it entered full force because it made sense at the time. We knew who the mother was. We didn't always know who the father was. There was questions. And for the preservation of the people, it was necessary. Patrilineality, on the other hand, would have created tremendous issues about inheritance and split up the people. So we didn't have it. Now let's fast forward to modern time. In the late 60s, early 70s, the Reform Movement adopted patrilineality or matrilineality to determine Jewish identity. They said either or. This was before they had DNA testing. They said it would depend upon how the child was raised. If the child was born to a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, but was raised in a Jewish household, sent to religious school from a synagogue or temple, and became bar mitzvah or confirmed, that child would be considered Jewish by birth. If the child instead was raised or baptized, the child would not be considered Jewish.
Now, is that still in effect today?
It is. It's often the second part is often ignored. There are a lot of the families in the Reform Judaism who have chosen to bring their child up in the religious school of the temple and also to baptize, and saying, "We'll let the kid decide when he gets older."
So they do both.
They're doing both, and by Reform movements, acknowledgement, that's not allowed. If you choose to baptize a child, the child is not to be considered Jewish by birth.
Right. Under Reform, you said?
Yeah. Reconstructionists accepted this as well. So two of the four streams of normative Judaism accepted it. Jewish identity to be identified by either parent, so long as the upbringing was Jewish. Conservative has not accepted it, nor has Orthodoxy.
No.
It is one of the biggest distinctive issues standing out right now between the streams of Judaism, and it is one of the most divisive. It means when a couple come to me to ask to be, me to officiate the marriage, first thing I have to do is establish identity. And I have to tell you, I've had one or two times where a young man or a young woman who thought they were Jewish got really angry at their parents for never telling them that the other streams of Judaism didn't accept that they were Jewish by birth. And I've had one or two get upset with me. I can't change the rules. There are some of the conservative rabbis who are trying to right now. Not with regard to identity, but with regard to officiated interfaith marriages. Some of which they say this is, and it came from this concept of the identity and the distinction. So who is a Jew? And the answer is, in today's world, it can be from either, depending on the stream of Judaism. Now, the question that's left then is it a race?
No, absolutely not a race.
Here's the problem. None of the normative distinctives fit. Somebody could say yes and no to every one of them. It starts out racially. Children of Israel, the 12 sons of Jacob. It starts out as a family, clan, race. It rapidly changes over on an immediate basis. And it may never have been totally just the children of Israel. Abraham, we are told, has a household that's able to field an army of over 600 men to go after his nephew Lot and rescue him. These are the men of his household. His family, it's referred to. Where did he get 600? He didn't have that many children. He didn't have any at that time. When Abraham brought somebody into the fold, and they professed the faith in Abraham's God, they became part of his family. He was the patriarch. He accepted him into the clan, into the tribe, and it became the larger tribe. It's how he became mighty. On a political level. Which meant it wasn't racial even at that time. Because you could join by bringing yourself to accept Abraham's God. Which involved, back then, real simple, profession of identity of one true God and rejection of all the idols. And for the men, it meant circumcision. When Dinah was raped, Jacob negotiates with the city of Shechem that they're all going to convert. They're going to become one family. And all the men in the city accept that they will become one family by circumcision. Shimon and Levi decide to avenge their sister's rape by going in and killing them all 3 days after they've had the surgery. But it meant that it couldn't be considered a race right from the beginning. So it was a family, but not a race.
And today, you can be circumcised and not be Jewish, so they do it as a health issue. So
yeah, one didn't mean, even back then, circumcision was practiced by other communities other than Israel. It was a combination of the profession of the belief of one God and the circumcision together that created the family issue. Mm-hmm. When Moses leads the people out, the word used is a mixed multitude. It wasn't just the Ivrim, the Hebrews who left Egypt with Moses. We know this because we find out later there's a famous argument between the son of an Israelite and the son of a non-Israelite. And Moses has to come in and intervene, and it becomes a major judicial case at that time. Even though all become adopted into different tribes, we know they didn't start out as all from the children of Israel. We're fairly certain from our own histories that it would have involved both the Israelites and the other slave peoples of Egypt, along with any others of Egypt or Egyptian ancestry who actually accepted God at that time and decided they would rather follow Moses and his God rather than Pharaoh. It's why we read, "This day all of you who stand today before me at Sinai are one people." Now, interestingly enough, this means we had a mixture of races right from the very beginning. The Nubians were one of the main slave peoples held by the Egyptians. For those who are not sure, were aware of the word, Nubian was another word for African. And interestingly enough, who does Moses marry?
Yeah, I've heard of this before. Is that interesting?
His first marriage, there's a problem. She stays with Daddy. And Daddy brings her to Moses at Sinai, together with Moses' two boys. But later he leaves and she goes home with him.
Jethro, right? Was that
mm-hmm. name? And Zipporah was his wife's name. And his two sons, Gershon and Eliezer? Gershon and... Well, one was Gershon. I can't remember the other one. Go home with her. And Yitro raises them. We don't hear about them again. There's no divorce. Everything is good. But there's a decision that he doesn't have the time to be a dad. And shortly after this, he marries. And he marries a Cushite woman. The word Cush... All right, what did I do with it?
What do you like more?
I had a black marker. I used it
earlier. Right here. You're worse than Bob.
Cush in Hebrew refers to Africa. So when you read, in fact, even today, the word Cushim refers to the black people from Africa. They don't particularly like that term. They've decided it's a negative, and they've actually changed it in modern Israel. But in biblical terms, Cush was the land of Africa. So when Moses finds another bride, he finds a Cushite woman, it says. Miriam gets upset about this, and Aaron backs her up. So guess what happens? God gets involved and chastises both of them, hits Miriam with leprosy, and says, "How dare you?" Miriam apologizes. Moses prays to God on her behalf. God forgives her, but says for 7 days she's outside of the camp with leprosy. She has shamed you. It's as if she shamed her father. She's not allowed back in for 7 days. Everyone has to learn this is not something to be ashamed of or a problem. It is something to accept. So what's going on? And the answer is a merging, a melding of different races. We weren't supposed to be worried about racial identity. We were supposed to be about the person.
I've got to read the story again now. I don't know.
The beauty of this, remember I said it's history in Jewish understanding is our story of our relationship with God. The events here were not major events in some respects. I mean, the idea of a man, you know, marrying a woman who's not the same race and God actually coming in and saying, wait a second, it's okay to her, his family, doesn't sound like a big deal. But it shaped us as a people. It said we weren't a race.
So anyone from any race today
can become
convert to Judaism. You have full...
If you go to Israel today...
How long has that been? That's goes probably all the way back.
All the way back.
So then from the day one, it was all about, never about race. It was always about...
That's what I'm saying. While it may have started as a family thing, we believe that even with Abraham, it wasn't just the family.
Yeah.
It became right away extended out beyond the family. And by the time we get to Moses, we know for sure it was. So it's not a race. There are many different races within Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been for many millennia. Do you have to be a professor of the Jewish religion to be a Jew? The answer is no. You can be born into it. And you can be an atheist. And still be Jewish. And identify as such. So it's not fully a religion.
Right.
Nor is it a philosophy. Nor is it a nation. The best word I've ever come up with is a people.
A peoplehood.
Bound by a common history, if you go back far enough. And yet, I'm not satisfied with that one, because how do I deal with that with those who have chosen to become Jewish, and there is no common history to go back far? So I'm left with that of, so either bound by the common history or choice of coming in. Choosing.
There is a history of people converting.
Yes.
Yeah.
So choosing to join. So we are not any of the normative, we don't fit into any of the normative definitions. If you're a Christian and you choose to reject Christianity, guess what? They say you're not a Christian anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Jewish and you reject God and the belief of Judaism, guess what? You're
still a Jew.
Jew.
So why is that?
Because it was it's neither religion nor people nor race. It was all of it. Any and all. And that's the problem with when you try to explain this to somebody from out to outside, it becomes problematic. Because they don't get it. They know the rules for their group. Our group was a little bit different. We basically said, look, you may not be Jewish, as in the religion, if you've chosen to reject it or you've gone over to another religion, but you're still Jewish by birth, or you were raised that way, you're still part of people.
But if you become baptized, are you still considered a Jew?
By Jewish law, you are not allowed to do most of the things that in Judaism would be allowed for a Jew to do, ritually, but they still consider you a Jew.
Even if you...
However, if you have a child, that child is not considered Jewish at that point. You don't pass it on. If the child was born after you accepted a different religion.
After.
You basically married into a different family.
The child would have to convert.
And the child would have to convert.
Yeah.
Does that clarify it for everyone? It's not an easy concept, and I acknowledge that. It's one of the harder ones to really grasp.
No, but I guess I could be an example, because I'm the only one in my family who decided to convert, because I grew up in a Judeo-Christian home, and you know, I grew up with all of that, but luckily I grew up in a home where we were allowed to ask questions. So I always got into trouble in Sunday school asking all these weird and wild questions. But when I started doing my research, I knew I was heading in a different direction.
Yeah.
And I mean, there was a time I was almost thinking about becoming an Episcopal priest, but when I started really getting into it, I thought, no, I'm going in a different direction.
Yeah.
So I chose to be here.
Yeah.
And yeah, some of my relatives think I'm going to hell in a handbasket, but hey, you know, it's the way it goes. But then again, I'm bringing some of them along with me.
There you go.
Yeah, them Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't come to my door. You'll be having some more converts.
The sharks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I can handle anybody who comes to my door.
All right, Sandra asked, what about DNA? And the answer is, DNA is established a certain branch of Judaism, or Jewish peoplehood, going all the way back. There's a marker that they call the priest marker or the Levite marker. They can actually tell if you actually are descended from Aaron.
If you're a Levite.
Aaron and Moses both were part of the tribe of Levi. All Kohanim are also from the tribe of Levi. Kohanim, priests, is not a tribe.
No.
It was a function. Mm-hmm. Levite was a tribe.
My father was a Levite.
Right. All priests were the tribe of Levi. Not all Levites were priests. That was restricted only to Aaron and his descendants. Today we talk about three identifications. You are an Israelite, you are a Levite, or you're a Kohen. Let's talk about those for a second. Kohen literally translates priest. It means you're a descendant of Aaron from the father's side. That was one that was patrilineal and function specific. Mm-hmm. Priests passed on the job of being a priest to their sons.
They were a descendant of who again? Jacob?
Aaron.
Oh, yeah.
Aaron was the first high priest, and it was only his sons that inherit the priesthood. There is a genetic marker that they've identified common to all Kohanim. All Kohanim also have a genetic marker that has been found common to the people of Levi. Many people who are not Kohen or Levite have the marker. I mean, somewhere in their history, somebody had a parent who was of that tribe. But they have broken it down that they can trace it back. So we now have genetic markers going back to ancient times. It doesn't mean that if you don't have it, you're not part of the Jewish people, though, because you may have joined today. What it does mean is that, like I said, it's a little bit of a mishmash of all of the above. What about the other 12 tribes? And there really are the 12. I'm not misreading. We call two of the tribes half-tribes, and to be honest, misnomer. They were actually bigger than some of the full tribes. They were half-tribes only in a literary sense. Not literal, but literary. Jacob adopted two sons of Joseph. And he basically did it and said, Joseph, you don't get anything. Your two sons get full shares. So Joseph would have gotten one share of the inheritance. And by adopting his two boys, he's able to give to Joseph's side two full shares. That makes it two tribes. If you count those two as full tribes, you end up with 13 tribes total. The myth of 10 lost tribes is just that. At no time in any of our history did we ever lose track of all 10 tribes or the people of. We will go through a map at another time showing you exactly where the tribe settled and why it never happened. But part of the reason I'll tell you right now is Judea, the kingdom of Judea, and the kingdom of Israel, the Israeli kingdom, which is the northern kingdom, had 10 tribes pledging allegiance to it. The southern kingdom had 5. The 10 lost tribes of Israel is referring to those who gave allegiance to the people as the capital of Samaria and the nation of Israel of ancient time that was taken into exile and never returned. Not all of the people disappeared. Not all the tribes representing the 12 tribes of Israel, or 13, disappeared. Remnants and parts of them lived in the south. Always did. Mm-hmm. We never lost all 10. Again, it's a reference to a political entity, not to the actual demographics. There was a political entity where 10 tribes broke away from the son of Solomon, because he was a real jackass. And they were conquered. By the way, prior to their being conquered, you should know, Jerusalem's greatest enemy during that time period after the breakoff was Israel. Jerusalem is the capital of Judea. Samaria is the capital of Israel. They battled each other back and forth. It was not an amicable breakup.
So it was tribes against tribes?
It was Jew against Jew.
A civil war?
It was a civil war in many respects. Although they broke off and created their own capital. And when you hear about the Samaritans who hated the Jews, the capital of Israel was Samaria. The Samaritans were
Jews.
Who no longer identified them with the people of Judea and actually couldn't stand the people who had stayed behind and had, etc. Family feuds can be the worst.
In the New Testament, there's a story about the Samaritan. Have you heard the story? That's amazing.
Exactly,
that's amazing.
But did they carry on as Jews, even though they didn't want the other part of being Jewish?
They remember the way they practiced Judaism back then was a little different than what we would think of today, or practice. They established a separate temple in Samaria. They had a priesthood. Levites lived among them. So you still had the practice of Moses' God taking place in the northern kingdom of Israel. The problem was they were more susceptible to secular influences and other cultural influences.
So they became Christians?
No, there was no Christianity. But they did become pagan, back and forth.
Yeah.
You had Jezebel, who brought in the worship of Baal, and the worship included human sacrifice. You have Elijah who comes in and basically destroys all the priests of Baal in one really famous episode in the Bible. He doesn't do it personally. There's a contest between the two, and the people end up killing the priests of Baal in their fear because God's going to punish them for following. And Jezebel and Ahab then turn and say, "We want that guy's head." So Elijah goes off into the desert.
Well, not to get too political, but is that a source of stress even today? Or has that pretty well been smoothed over? Or does it carry over?
It doesn't carry over, mainly because the Samaritans have disappeared. There is no remnant of Samaria or Samaritans around anymore. Mm-hmm. And we can probably thank a combination of the Greek and Roman influences of that time who merged and melded what was left into one.
And how about the other tribes? I mean, what?
What do you mean, other tribes?
Well, you're talking about the 12 tribes.
Remember, I said, well, we start out with 13 in total. We never lose all 13.
Okay.
We never lose all of any one tribe that we're aware of.
Okay, but you said that maybe I misunderstood that they were kind of squabbling, family squabbles between them.
I
or is
said
that just
when
between
they
them
when
and
the when
the
kingdoms break up.
I see.
To northern and southern, they end up in a constant state of warfare until Israel itself is conquered by the Assyrians.
I see. Okay.
And takes their people off.
I was just wondering, you know, all the stress that's happening today, if it...
Yeah. No.
When did the breaking up of... Reform, conservative, and orthodox.
Oh, you're jumping way ahead in the class.
I
will give you a hint on that, of just giving you an approximate date of when the first reform tendrils start. 1830s. In the 1830s, a group of German Orthodox rabbis started meeting and discussing change. And that's where it starts. Up to that time, there is nothing but orthodoxy. In the 1840s, they established a platform. And remember, the first major immigration from Germany, I remember these were the German rabbis, came in the 1860s. So they had almost 20 years to establish Reform Judaism over there, and they imported it here. By the 1880s, when the next major immigration starts here, there is a push to establish a response to the Reform movement here in America. And they call themselves the conservatives. At that time, there was no orthodoxy here in the United States. The conservative movement was the orthodox movement of Judaism of that time. Hard to wrap your mind around that somewhat, but it was. Okay. Let's go on. Any questions on what we've covered so far?
The 12 tribes. What exactly happened with all 12 tribes?
I need to get you the maps so you can see what I'm talking about. Let me see if one of them is here.
I'm thinking they're still around.
Most... The actual tribal affiliation concepts are still there.
And if you did a DNA test, would you be able to tell?
I don't know. I'm going to pass this around so you get an idea of what was happening. Let me start with you just so you have an idea.
Okay.
When they enter into the Promised Land, they're basically divided up into different areas of land.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Manasseh, Gad, Reuben, Judah down here. You know, Shimon is also here. Benjamin, Dan, Ephraim. Manasseh is also over here. Issachar, Zebulun.
These
become further divided up. Dan ends up on the coast as well. So even though you have Dan over here...
Mm-hmm.
His coastal thing goes all the way up.
Mm-hmm.
Manasseh is on both sides of the Jordan. Ephraim actually ends up in both sides of the Jordan too, because he ends up up here as well. Dan also ends up all the way up here.
Yeah. And how did the 12 tribes get started to begin with again?
The sons of Jacob.
Okay.
Jacob has two names, Jacob and also Israel. So what happens is they get an initial inheritance from Moses dividing it out. Later, after they finish conquering the land, segments go into different areas on top of that, where they conquered it in addition to what they already had. So Dan ends up with a part all the way up in the north, in an area right now contingent to the border with Syria and Lebanon, right where the two meet. Dan was up there.
So Moses...
So we have the Dan River,
yeah,
as an example today, from that time, and there's still... You can go up there archaeologically into the Banyans and the Dan River Basin and find one of the ancient cities of Dan still in existence.
Wow. But Moses made the determination who's going to go where.
Right. Moses basically allots it out.
On his deathbed?
Actually, well, let me correct that. Moses allots some of it. Moses allots everything that's on the eastern side of the Jordan before he dies. They've already conquered it. Joshua does the rest of the division afterwards as they conquer. But it's not contiguous territory. So you might have had, as an example, and I'm using Dan as one of the best examples.
It looks like
you should stop hiding it. Dan has a section over here, but he also has a section over here, and then he's got this section over here on the coast. Shimon has a section carved out of Judah down here, but he also has a section up here. The Levites have no section at all. They're scattered among all of them.
Yeah, they're not here.
They're not there because they were supposed to be servants of God. They served God. They didn't have any inheritance at all. They could own a house in a city, but they could not own property other than that. You know, they never got fields, never got to a farm,
so
no
you
agriculture.
Say inheritance, Moses gave everybody pieces of land.
Yes. And Joshua determined out... So each tribe gets a section of land, but again, it wasn't always contiguous. Nor did they want it to be. Manasseh and Ephraim were very friendly with each other. They wanted to be together.
Mm-hmm.
So they agreed. Part of it will be up here and part of it will be down here. Mm. Reuben, a little bit more of a problem. He didn't want to share with anyone. Seriously. His tribe really, and Reuben as a person wasn't so high either.
Mm-hmm.
But... For the majority of the tribes, we know that segments of them still existed after the Assyrian conquers. That while they talk about 10 lost tribes, the reason they do that is the northern kingdom was known as the 10 tribes of Israel.
And the other three?
It wasn't just three. That's why you're conflating two different things.
Oh.
The people as a whole, when they enter into Canaan... have 13 tribes. But by the time they separate and apportion out all the land, that tribal identity is gone. However, when the northern kingdom of Israel breaks away from Judea after Solomon's death, 10 remnants of tribes are identified within that northern kingdom. In other words, you have a section of 10 tribes within that northern kingdom,
okay,
and they're the majority of those 10. They're not the totality. They break away. They're the ones that we talk about being lost. It doesn't mean the total of all the tribe got lost. It means that part that broke away and stayed as the northern kingdom of Israel and got defeated by the Syrians disappears in history. However, sections of Dan and Shimon and Benjamin and Judah and Gad and Manasseh and Ephraim all existed outside of that area. And they continue to exist. So it would be the equivalent of saying that Hitler had destroyed all the Jews. No, Hitler had destroyed 1/3 of the Jews. Did he destroy all the European Jews? No, because many of the Jews who came here to America or to Israel or other places started out in Europe.
Mm-hmm. So when the Messiah comes, is something supposed to happen with these tribes?
Let's not get there. That's
okay.
Different subject, different time.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go to another time. I did want to leave time today to go a little bit further into this. You've got geographical and cultural groups. What we haven't dealt with is Ashkenazic and Sephardic. This is such fun. It's almost as if we feel like we have to create divisions, and we're not happy without having something divisive. So let me see if I can explain this one. We all started out simply as Jews. When the Romans take us out of Canaan, out of Judea, out of what we consider modern Israel today, they don't remove all the Jews, but they do remove a majority. They glut the market on slaves. They took enough so that we're told that 1 million slaves, Jewish slaves, entered into the Roman market within a single month. So we have the diaspora. Now, the majority of Jews obviously are going to be in the Roman Empire. What were the two centers of Roman Empire at that time? Anybody? It wasn't Germany. Germany was where the opposition was. You had the Huns in Germany.
What was the question?
What were the two major centers of the Roman Empire back at that time?
Constantinople?
No, that comes later. Constantinople is much later.
It's Rome.
Rome and?
I don't know.
Iberia.
Spain.
Which today we call?
Spain.
The Iberian Peninsula was one of the main centers of the Roman Empire. And Rome itself, Italy.
Yeah.
So guess where the vast majority of the Jews end up? Rome.
Spain.
And
Spain.
Italy. And Spain.
And Spain.
We end up there as slaves. However, one of Jewish law issues says, you will not let your brother languish in slavery, you will redeem him. Some Jews were still free people. We had a very active merchant class who were living already in different parts of the Roman Empire with Roman citizenship. They were not affected by the fall of Jerusalem and Judea. They set about for generations to redeem the slaves who were taken slaves when Judea fell. Many of the Jews who left Judea were redeemed, and they started to build very large Jewish communities outside of Judea. Some Jewish communities had pre-existed and still continued. The temple in Alexandria, Egypt, was still giving animal worship and doing animal worship 400 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. Same thing with the temple in Antioch. The Jews in the Roman Empire became a prominent factor. Judea became problematic for them in many ways, because we had two revolts. We ended up costing the Romans more in men and money than any other province had ever done in their history. They really did not like us. We were troublemakers. But the vast majority of Jews lived in one of two places, both of which came to be considered Sephardic, Spanish influence, because the majority were in Iberia. Italy was also Sephardic. So you had Sephard, Sephard actually means Spain. The Sephardic Jews are those who established themselves in those countries where the Romans originally brought us, basically. History likes to meddle in, though. We had merchants going all over. King Casimir of Poland invited a Jewish group to come and start to inhabit Poland. And I can't give you the exact date because I don't remember it. But I'm sure we'll find it in one of the timelines. And we had the first major Jewish population entering into Poland. From Poland, they spread. Casimir actually protects us, encourages us. We spread from Poland into Germany, Lithuania,
Estonia,
throughout Eastern Europe, not so much Western.
And what about the Ashkenazis? It's born later, right?
Those are the people who went to Poland, Germany, and Eastern Europe.
What is the...
They become known as the Ashkenazic Jews. They start out Sephardic. But once they establish themselves in that section of Eastern Europe and later Germany as well, it becomes Ashkenazic. And the within Ashkenazic, you have a break. You have... Anyone know the two major breaks? Litvak and Galiciana. If you were from Galicia, or if you were from Lithuania. It didn't mean you were actually from one of those two countries, it meant you were from the influence of one of those two. Mm-hmm. Lithuania was the head of the major Orthodox of Eastern Europe. You had the Vilna Gaon of Lithuania, and if you were in that group, you were Litvak. If you were in the other group from Galicia, you didn't go along with them, and you spoke slightly different with a different accent. Like I said, we seem to be intent on creating divisiveness. Here in America, the original Jewish population of America was Sephardic. In fact, the very first were those who ran from persecution in Recife, down in Brazil. And they arrived here into New Amsterdam and were welcomed very coldly by Peter Stuyvesant, who at first actually tried to kick them out. However, the Dutch Indies Company had several Jewish factors. A factor was a majority shareholder. Several members of the board were Jewish. And Peter Stuyvesant was their employee. He was Captain General of New Amsterdam. They basically sent out a requirement. He had to let them in. And he had to back off. He was an anti-Semite, by the way, first order. Then Rhode Island gets established. Rhode Island establishes itself as a religious sanctuary. It was a reaction to the Puritans of Massachusetts. And Jews go in there as part of the sanctuary concept. So the oldest synagogue in the United States actually is established, not in New Amsterdam, but in Rhode Island. Sephardic Jews were the majority of the Jews here in this country up until the 1860s. Sephardic Jews fought in the Revolutionary War. In the War of 1812. And the Civil War. Some of the more common names that everyone knows. There was a gentleman named Isaacs who... My family thing. He was one of the major spies who got caught and killed during the Revolutionary War. Fortunately, he'd already had children. Judah Philip Benjamin, Secretary of the Treasury, and then Secretary of the War, and then eventually Vice President of the Confederacy. Jews played a major part in the founding of this country. They also played on the other side. Chaim Salomon, the major funder for the revolution. The only one, every time Congress needed money, guess what? They kept going to him and saying, help us find and raise the money. He was a brilliant genius. The histories are out there. So what happened? Well, in the 1860s, we saw a major influx which almost balanced the two. And they came from Germany. Mm-hmm. And the balance was established for about 20-some-odd years. It was almost equal balance. But when I give you those numbers, I need you to understand, at that point, we only had about 300,000 Jews here in the United States total. Mm-hmm. Within a 20-year period from the 1880s to the 1900s, it will change to over 3 million, all coming from Eastern Europe, which means the vast majority of Jews in the United States came from Eastern Europe during the 1880s, 1890s, and following. It's when we had the major settling at that point of Judaism here in this country, in their centers. All right. I did want to go over one other modern denominations I'm not going to deal with right now. I told you we would deal with another time. All right, we will deal with the denominations at a time. I wanted to give at least 5 to 10 minutes for those. I've been asking you to keep journals as you write, as you read. And if questions come up, to please write those questions down. I'm hoping you've actually been doing that. And I'm going to give time every few classes to say, okay, let's start dealing with some of the questions you've written down. So let's go around the table. Does anyone have questions that they wrote into their journals? Things that they read or they will have questions?
The Jewish people that, you know, we're talking about the Sephardic and the Ashkenazic, those that came, like, from the Ukraine or even in some of the Oriental countries, but would they have been a certain group?
They would have been Ashkenazic, with one exception. If their families came from one of the Sephardic bastions prior to, you know, here's, the Sephardic grouping is not as easy to trace back in some respects. The Sephardic Jews all start out in Spain and Italy, basically. But they spread from there into Turkey and throughout the Arab lands as we know them today.
Okay.
Today we call those Mizrahi, the Eastern Jews, mm-hmm. Arabic countries. But they're also, if a Mizrahi is automatically Sephardic.
Okay.
In 1492, not just Columbus sailing, but all the Jews get kicked out of Spain. And a very large contingent go overland to Hungary. They're invited. A couple hundred thousand. A majority of Hungarian Jews are Sephardic. If you come from Budapest and you have Hungarian ancestry, there's a better than average chance that you are actually Sephardic ancestry.
Okay.
All right. And they kept somewhat separate from the rest of Europe. The Hungarian Jews were accepted fully on a different level than any other part of Europe. They did not deal with anti-Semitism. They were allowed to own property. They had citizenship. And they were protected by the crowns. Until Austro-Hungary became a reality, and Austria basically conquered Hungary and took over. And all of a sudden, many of the rights got taken away. The Jewish community was well established at that point. During the Holocaust, the Hungarian people, for the most part, helped protect the Jews. They were among the last of the Jewish communities to be taken.
They were taken.
They were in the end. But they were among the last communities to be taken. There was a group called the Iron Arrow in Hungary, which was the fascist group. But they were never a majority party. And the key part there is to recognize that the Hungarian people never backed Hitler and Hitler's fascists. You had a small group that did, and they had the power. What's interesting is today's world, Budapest is still one of the friendliest cities in Europe to Jews, and it's one of the few places throughout Europe today where you're not seeing any anti-Semitism being displayed. In fact, the opposite. In Budapest and in surrounding communities, you have major festivals arranged with the Israeli cultural embassies.
Very nice.
It's common and normal. And they talk about
it. My grandfather from Hungary.
From Hungary?
All right.
Lasers in.
Excuse me, Rabbi, what about Romania?
Oh.
Romania was a different ballpark. They were mostly Ashkenazic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was never a sizable grouping.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest grouping came in after World War I. Post-World War I, some of the refugees from the war,
mm-hmm.
Jewish refugees, made it over to Romania
mm-hmm.
and thought they would be out of the way of any next war. It didn't work out that way.
No.
As a matter of fact, since the Roma,
mm-hmm.
you can guess where they get the name, were particularly targeted by Hitler, along with Jews, it became a double whammy.
Yeah.
Well, I know that neighbor that used to live across the street from my grandparents years ago was from the Ukraine, and he was a Holocaust survivor from the Ukraine. But I was really little at the time. But I've got a friend who lives in Maryland who may be related to the fishing, because her family goes back to the African, Jewish Africans.
Most of the people who are totally black in the Jewish community today came from Ethiopia, are from Yemen. The Yemenite Jews shot many of the Ashkenazic Jews when they first met them because many of the Yemenite Jews were so dark as not to be differentiated from anybody who's from Africa.
Were they considered the lost tribe, though?
No.
No?
The Ethiopian Jews were never considered the lost tribes. We don't have... They also termed that the B'nai Menashe, the people they found in India who go back to and remember a affiliation with the tribe of Menashe. And DNA is now saying that they may very well be right. Just as they found with the Ethiopian Jews that the priest within the Ethiopian community had the DNA for the Kohanic and Levite priesthood.
Yeah, they could do that.
Well, besides that, a lot of people can do that even without...
Oh, really?
You don't have to be born into it to be able to do it.
Oh, okay.
And my sister, who was born into a Kent.
Yeah.
So we've been scattered, and little by little we're finding different remnants of people who got lost on the way. India, Ethiopia, now in Uganda there's a group that's been found that's been claiming membership.
Yeah.
The first Ugandan student for the Reform Rabbinate just was accepted in.
Maybe that's what I was thinking of.
And they have accepted them fully. We know where the people in China come from. We know when that started. We have an idea of the same thing in Japan.
Isn't that kind of a blessing in disguise, though? Because if you knew where all the Jews were and they were all in one clump, that's what my concern is for Israel. I mean, one big bomb and boom, it's gone. But so we're scattered.
We really were scattered to the four corners.
So.
Yeah.
And...
That was
every now and then a new group comes up. There was a group called the Khazars, and there was a mythology that it was the 10 lost tribes. It wasn't. The Khazars, the Khazarite Jews, and they were Jews, converted to Judaism.
Mm.
It was in the steppes of Russia, and this guy who had Tatar and Hun and Mongol background had... come into contact with some Jews who taught him a little bit of their philosophy, and he sent and asked for a rabbi to come. Rabbi came. He studied with him for several years, and he decided he wanted to be Jewish. He converted, and then he ordered all his people to convert. And in that community, that was... You didn't fight the king. You didn't. Eventually, they were defeated in a battle and basically wiped out. But for a while, we had a kingdom. We also had a kingdom in France during the time of Charlemagne. We had a Jewish kingdom that was established under Charlemagne's rule as a Princeton. And I don't remember the exact name of the place. I actually have those papers inside. But
really?
It was a separate Jewish kingdom in medieval France.
It's amazing. But when you look at, when you read this in the back of the book, it's amazing that any of us exist today the way we were kicked out of everywhere. Nobody wants us. Nobody. Still today, it's the same way. That
if you read history the way most historians have in the past, the way we actually went through that listing, and anything other than relationship between the people and God, we should not be here. We defy all parameters of normative history of any nation, people, existing, or religion existing after the events. The fact that we continue to do so defies the normative.
All logic.
And it's why we prefer looking at history as a story of the relationship between people and God.
Isn't it problematic, though, to force somebody to convert? I mean, would that have been considered...
That's not really a conversion.
I mean, if somebody came to me and said, you will convert...
Well, let's put it this way. If you live under an autocratic king who has power of life and death, and he says, I want all my people to convert to the religion I've accepted, guess what?
Well, they're going to probably...
Everyone does it.
Yeah.
It wasn't done just by the Khazars. Constantine did the same thing.
Exactly.
Constantine basically turned to all of the Christians of his time period, and there were many divisions. And he said, no, the only one that's going to be acceptable at this point is this one. And if you don't believe in this one, I've got enough executioners ready to go.
Right.
So everyone converted to Constantine's understanding of Christianity.
But you can convert... But in your heart, still be something else.
Yeah, give it a generation or two, and guess what? You don't remember the issue.
Ah.
Same thing with Jews during the Inquisition. Jews during the Inquisition got confronted with a choice. You either accepted the Inquisition, fled Spain, or you lived as a secret Jew.
Yeah.
But if you had to go in total secret, after a few generations, people forgot. We're finding people in parts of South America who still practiced Jewish rituals but didn't know why they were doing it, who lit Friday night candles in secret as part of the ritual. Their ritual was you went to a room, in some cases a basement or a closet, you covered all the windows, and you lit the candles. And you said this weird incantation, which was, by the way, a mispronunciation of the blessing of the candles. But they had been doing it for hundreds of years. And it was passed down from family to family, you know, from one generation to the next. What got lost was why they did it. What got lost was telling, they couldn't tell children you're Jewish, because somebody might, a child might open their mouth. And so down the road, before the kids grew old enough, parents died. But they knew the rituals. And so you had what was called until modern time Muranos, which actually means pigs, so its name was thrown out the door. Instead, we use the word conversos today. Those who pretended to convert to Christianity and practiced their religion in secret. All right, as best they could. And they spread all over. There was a bishop recently in the Catholic Church who found out. He went for DNA testing. He was shocked to find out he was mostly Ashkenazi. And he did the whole test, and when he found out, not only was he Ashkenazi, but prior to that, the family was from Spain, had gone into Germany. Mm-hmm. He got the whole family history. He was able to trace it back. And he found out they were, when they went to Germany, it was as conversos. They left Spain as Jews and arrived in Germany as Christians.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that the Pope was the one who ordered the Jews to live in ghettos, you know.
Urban.
In
Pope Italy. Urban, I think the second. Yeah, not one of the nicer ones. All right. Let's stop the recording, but still going. Hopefully it is. And if you would send that to Irma in a Dropbox.
All right.
That's the way to send it, I'm told.
You could probably send it as a file.
It's going to be too big to send as a file. We found out. In fact, I have to send... Barry's going to help me send the first three that I have.
You just hit that.
Yeah. Well, that's the other way.